I don't know if I was ever scared by a movie because I understood the barrier between my safety zone and what was happening to the characters. And I was always fascinated by people who didn't recognize that barrier. Like my sister, when Halloween came out, she was babysitting, and my brother and I had to go over and basically chaperone her so she wouldn't be alone because she had just seen Halloween. And I just thought, how stupid.
That is true, though. We talked about Korean horror, we talked about French horror, but the Australians are having a moment.
Yeah, they're doing good. I mean, the Evil Dead Rise cast, I feel, was just invaded by Australians.
Oh, that's right. Uh-huh. That is right. And then Talk to Me, and now Lena with the Devil.
Yeah.
They're taking over. They're coming with a vengeance.
And Lee Whannell.
Oh.
Whenever he's making stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if that becomes like a cinematic subcategory, like Australian horror. I really want to see that on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, that's the subcategory.
Sissy was Australian. Did you ever see that?
No, I didn't see
that's
Sissy.
That's real good. It's got a kangaroo in it, so.
I'm all for like animals. I was just I got a text from our friend Spencer Charnas the last night saying he was with the Pooh people, and it took me a minute to like understand what he was talking about.
Only Spencer would text at like 10:30 being like, I'm with the Pooh people, you gotta come.
And I'm like, I'm not coming to West Hollywood. I love, look, all, much love to Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey team, but I was not going to the Pooh people at 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome to Scream Dreams, the Nightmares That Shaped Us, where we sit down with your favorite horror and genre filmmakers and creatives and talk about the things that really terrify them. I'm Catherine Corcoran.
I'm James A. Janisse, and today we're talking to Mr. Brian Fuller.
Hey. Hello!
How's it going?
Thanks for being with us.
Now you're on camera.
Yay! Thank you for having me.
This is so exciting. I feel like you've run such a gamut of work. I mean, what were you? I know you did. You started with like Star Trek. Really, was your big show? Were you more of a sci-fi person or horror, like in your subgenres of horror?
I sci-fi horror was definitely what I was most attracted to. So I think Alien was my Star Wars.
Yeah.
And things like Battlestar Galactica or The Black Hole were really appealing to me because they were much more actively horror. They had a lot of scares. There's something about The Black Hole where it's, you know, somebody murders their entire crew and turns them into work zombies.
Yeah.
And those elements of combining horror with science fiction is really where I lived. And I think Close Encounters has a lot of horror elements in it.
Yeah.
So those were the things that kind of piqued my imagination. I grew up in a very small town. Star Wars didn't come to the town until like deep into the summer.
Really?
Because it was when there were, you know, limited prints and
the
prints would travel releases. Around.
Yeah.
And we were just one of those towns that got everything late. So I don't think Star Wars, you know, came out end of May. We didn't get it until July. Mm. But all of the kids that I knew, their parents took them to the next town over to see it.
Yeah.
But I didn't go. So I didn't have that kind of ownership of Star Wars because I felt like it like flew past me and I didn't have access to it for a long time. And by the time I did get access to it, all of the other kids were way ahead of me.
Uh-huh.
And it's okay. I stole their Star Wars figures. So it all balanced out in the end. But yeah, I was definitely science fiction and horror is where I lived and loved. And I was aware of Dark Star, John Carpenter film that had quasi alien elements, but instead of, you know, xenomorph, it was a big tomato.
Yeah.
So
Event Horizon, are you a fan of that?
Yes. I think, you know, when I first saw it, I was like, huh. And then it has grown on me. A lot of his movies grow on me.
Mm-hmm.
When I first saw Alien versus Predator, I was like, meh. And then I saw some other Alien movies, and I was like, this isn't so bad. And grew to appreciate it, and now I'm kind of an AVP apologist.
You have the will they, won't they between Sanaa Lathan and the Predator.
Right,
you know?
Right. It's sexy. It's a sexy matchup.
Yeah.
Honestly, now they're my favorite. The Alien franchise is my favorite, I think, but like in the beginning of my genre journey, I hated it.
All of them? Even the first two?
Yes. I think it was just, Whoa. It was so gross, and it was because it actually scared me. I think that's really what it was. And it wasn't like a scary, like, oh, I'm going to have nightmares. Like, it grossed me out.
Right.
And that was my first experience of that. And I was like, I don't want this. And then as I've gotten older, I'm like, I love this. I love the like weird sexual gross out. I love making that like a challenging thing for people.
Well, I was exposed to it when I was 9. Uh-huh. And they had the Alien photo novel that was every frame of the movie was laid out in a book, a photo buster book. And they used to have these photo novels. They would do all the Star Trek episodes. You know, they would just take all of the frames and assemble them in a graphic novel format, but they would be photorealistic. So I saw that before the movie even came to theaters, and I pored over every frame. And it was kind of the first time. I mean, I was 9, so of course it's going to be the first time where I really understood the importance of production design.
Yeah.
And because I'm looking at all of these images going like, that's a penis, that's a vagina, you know, and being able to go, oh, they are using something Freudian or Jungian in terms of the symbolism and the production design of the movie that kind of blew my mind in a way. So I had been prepping for a year off of this photo novel that it was at the grocery store. I hid it underneath the magazine rack and up so they couldn't get rid of it. Nobody would buy it. So every time my mom went to the grocery store, I sat there in the magazine rack and I read the photo. I dug it out from where I hid it. So it would always be there for me.
I do think that's something that like people, I think in like I feel bad for this generation of kids and like the age of the internet that they miss out on that kind of stuff. I remember, and I don't even remember which, it's the, whatever Star Wars has, maybe it's Natalie Portman in it. When it was coming out, I was never a big Star Wars person, but my dad was a big sci-fi horror person, so he was getting me into all of this stuff. I talk on the show all the time how he got me into like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and then the Lord of the Rings and like stuff like that. So naturally, he showed me Star Wars. It never really hit, but he showed it to me, and I remember we're going to the theater to see, and he got me like the Lego sets that came out before the film came out, and these like books and things to kind of like get me excited about the production of it.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm dating myself, but I feel like in the age of like the internet, kids don't really have that as much anymore. It's so fleeting, that like tangible building of like holding something and like getting excited about it before you see it.
Well, I think it's a combination of things, because now it's an over access to those things. So I feel like they have even more access, but they have access to so many things that are eclipsing the more interesting minutiae and how to make a film. And I think you hit on something interesting because it's science fiction or horror or fantasy, it's a genre that requires a certain amount of production to create. Yeah. And I think for folks who have a creative response to those worlds are intuiting a world-building experience from the filmmakers automatically because it's not the real world. So that has to be created in some way. So I think for a lot of us who find ourselves in entertainment in whatever capacity, we're thinking about how they built that world. We're thinking about, you know, whether it's a crappy rock planet from, you know, the original Star Trek, where, you know, we understand that somebody put that on a stage and had to put that together. They couldn't just go out to a field and shoot, or into a home and shoot. They had to create and design environments. And I feel like that, in a very subtle way, probably activated a lot of storytellers, because they started to understand and intuit the world-building capacity of production and storytelling that fantasy, horror, and science fiction do kind of like exclusively.
Yeah. One of the things that my wife and I always talk about on our podcast is how pivotal and influential the special features on Lord of the Rings DVDs were for people our age, because you know, before streaming, you would have to get the DVD. And so you're watching the movie and then you watch it so many times. You're like, what else does this disc have? Oh, these making of. And you see yeah. all the work that goes into making these movies. And I think that those like featurettes really inspired a lot of people our age. I'm like, oh, there are all these different aspects of filmmaking that I could go into. That's not just writing and directing. It's like, oh, I really like decorating places. I could be a set designer or yeah. a production designer.
Yeah. Well, you're seeing people in cargo shorts and t-shirts mm-hmm. behind the scenes of these very elaborate constructed worlds. And you're like, you may not be able to see yeah. yourself in Princess Leia buns, but you can see yourself in the guy with the cargo shorts and his shirt off holding the light deflector and going like, oh, real people make this. I'm a real person. I have access to this. Because I do think that there is a bit of a barrier. There certainly was for me growing up where I was like, oh, that is what other people do that have mm-hmm. access to those things that I don't have access to. And then you meet a teacher along the way that says, no, you can have access too. You just have to follow these roads to get to that access.
Yeah.
And I think that is something unique about genre storytelling that is inspiring uniquely as opposed to a more straightforward drama mm-hmm. or comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned growing up in a small town. Where was that?
I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in a little community. It was called the Lewis Clark Valley. So it was Lewiston, Idaho, and Clarkson, Washington, separated by the Snake River. And
which side were you on? Were you in Idaho or Washington?
The house was in Washington, but we didn't have a movie theater in Clarkson. Okay. So we would cross the bridge to go to the movie theater in Lewiston. But that was also a small movie theater. And if you really wanted to see something that was big, you'd have to drive either to Moscow or Pullman or Spokane.
Okay.
To see how a Star Wars.
How far was the drive?
Moscow and Pullman, 45 minutes. Wow. Spokane, 2 hours.
Oh, damn.
So
it's like a pilgrimage to yeah. see a film.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Well, to see a film that you on immediate release, yeah. as opposed to waiting a couple weeks, and you know, you'd check the newspapers, and I would call like the Tuesday, going like, "What movies are coming on Friday?" And yeah. they would never get the good ones quick.
Yeah,
because I mean,
those
we now still have like 3,000 theaters for a movie.
Yeah.
But then it was like you're lucky to have 1,000 movies that were getting a print.
Yeah.
So, or you know, 1,000 theaters that would yeah. get a movie print. So it was a different environment in the 70s and 80s.
Did it, I guess, how did that inform then, like, what scared you? If you enjoyed these kind of horror sci-fis, did they give you nightmares? Did they kind of...
The scare, like, when I saw Alien, I was not scared as much as I was thrilled because I wasn't on a spaceship. I knew these things did not have access to my reality. Yeah. And so I was firmly planted in my seat as an audience member and able to kind of enjoy them as that's thrilling for those characters to be going through this harrowing experience. And I am perfectly safe. And when I watched Alien, I watched it at like 6 a.m. because it was playing on Showtime on cable. Oh. And I had a blanket over the TV in the living room. Oh. And I had the volume very low.
Oh, you didn't want to disturb anyone. Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to alert anyone.
Yeah. Oh, it was a secret.
That I was watching an R-rated movie at 6 a.m. in the morning as a 9-year-old.
I'm sure your like mom comes out for like coffee and it's just like full phallic alien on yeah. at like 6:30.
Look, mom. So what scared me, I don't know if I was ever scared by a movie because I understood the barrier between my safety zone and what was happening to the characters. And I was always fascinated by people who didn't recognize that barrier. Like my sister, when Halloween came out, she was babysitting, and my brother and I had to go over and basically chaperone her so she wouldn't be alone because yeah. she had just seen Halloween. And I just thought, how stupid.
Was it younger sister or older sister?
Older sister. I was the youngest of five.
Then, I could see being like, what?
You're really, that was a movie. But we were living in a town that had serial killers. So I get the concern.
Who are the serial killers in your town?
Well, the Lewis Clark Valley has a lot of murders. Uh-huh. I mean, the last time I went there, I basically was like, there's nothing to do. So, Mom, let's get in the car and take me around to every murder site that you're aware of, that you remember, where you had heard about somebody dying. And we spent the afternoon driving around going like, okay, those apartments that are abandoned, like they found a bunch of women strangled in there. And this is where the guy was, where they found his head chopped off. What? And
So like it gruesome was, murders.
Was it all David the same Lynch serial town. Killer? Yeah.
There were random murders, and then there was a serial killer that from 78 to 85, I think, was pretty active, and he got away with it. He didn't get caught because...
Well, you do back then, you know.
There's no DNA evidence. Exactly, there was nothing... The spurt of 70s serial killers are what inspired DNA evidence, because if you go back and you look at sort of... you know, Americana and Americana history, there are all sorts of theories of why we had the glut of 70s serial killers.
What are they? I don't even know this.
Well, a lot of them is war. So we had men returning from war in World War II.
And being trained to kill people.
Yeah.
Well, being damaged and also being fed a line of Americanaism and what the ideal American home is and the white picket fence and what you have to achieve and keeping up with the Joneses. Mm-hmm. That was all that era. So what you had is women who were in the workforce suddenly displaced by men returning home from war. So women were then in charge of carrying out the culty aspects of Americana with their children. And basically telling little boys that this is everything that you have to do in order to succeed. And if you don't do it, you'll be punished and you won't be able to move on with your life in any sort of meaningful way. So all of those damaged little boys from the 50s and 60s grew up recognizing a female influence that was telling them how to be in a way that they couldn't see a path to because it was an impossible standard for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
So then they grew up into the 70s wanting to kill people who reminded them of their mothers at a very reductive level. Yeah. You know, we have that aspect of why we have serial killers. We also have the Vietnam War and people returning from that trauma. And so... with the 70s, you have this culmination of World War II boomer babies being sold on what it is to be a proper American, realizing that they can't live up to those standards, being sold that by primarily female role models, and then growing up to resent those female role models for selling them on a bill of goods that was unachievable for them. So that's... there's that sort of theory about why men started killing women a lot in the 70s and randomly. And then you can sort of break down some of the various serial killers and what their damage was. But it usually kind of traces back to a lot of people being fed an idealism that was unachievable. Like, I remember watching the Brady Bunch as a kid, and there were times where my dad was yelling at my mom for the house being messy. And I was like, if we had an Alice, this wouldn't be a problem. And you wouldn't be yelling so much.
Yeah.
So, but I didn't realize that, oh, you have to have money to have a cleaning person.
That's what you live in.
Like, I had no idea of it, but we were being sold all of these ideals on how to function, and the dysmorphia between what we were being presented as a way to be and what people felt they were actually capable of is what created this big divide.
You're like unlocking this like epiphany for me, and maybe I'm totally off base here, but in the rise of serial killers in the 70s to now, the mass shooting phenomenon now, which is a very similar, statistically commonly white male of a certain age kind of action that's taken. And I'm kind of fascinated by this ideal, because I think maybe, and let me know what you think about this, it comes from this kind of like, you see the rise of like things like Columbine into what's happening now, right at the beginning of the like No Child Left Behind era, where we're fed this like educational standard of perfectionism by like test scores, and also like the American dream is like faltering, where it's like, oh, all you have to do is check these boxes, get this test score, go to this college, and then you will have the life that you need, and you will make plenty of money, and you will have the house with 3.5 kids in the suburbs and the white picket fence. And we have just discovered that that is not actually how it works. That is not how a capitalist society works. It doesn't make it attainable. Education is not always the platform to wealth or success or employment or stability, be that mental stability or financial. And I feel like you're seeing this like kind of bubble pop amidst other things.
Yeah, I think there is a fallacy when we get into talking about Klebold and Harris and Columbine, that those were two very privileged white kids, and so it's a different kind of schism that is created with these young men, and particularly young men who are fantasize about mass shooters. And what's interesting about Klebold and Harris is that very privileged, very supported by their parents. It wasn't any of the things of like, my dad beat me, so I'm going to kill animals and, you know, eventually women. For Klebold and Harris, it was really kind of the dysmorphia, again, of having immense privilege, but yet not being able to activate that privilege as a social currency in some way. So that was kind of the schism or the breakdown between what they expected, what they wanted, what they were promised. So it's a similar thing, but it's almost an inversion, because with those kids, it's an entitlement
that is not there,
that then extends over ownership of other people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think entitlement is the right word in terms of how that paradigm shifted from people who were not entitled feeling like entitlement was beyond their reach from what they were being sold, to people who were entitled, did have access, but still resented all of the elements that were in any way telling them who they should be.
Yeah.
And so privilege comes into play in a really interesting way as an element of, you know, because when we, like, 40s and 50s, you know, we're returning from the world at war. There is a lot of, you know, access to basics of food and jobs that are in turmoil. We have a big gender divide because women were running the country very efficiently, thank you very much, without the men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the men came in very threatened by what the women were doing. And then the women were then, you know, uncomfortable with being displaced for years, going like, oh, wow, we are active in our own stories and we have control of our lives, and that being ripped away from them by the men returning from war. So there's a lot of privilege and entitlement when we come into horror and the killers that we fetishize, fantasize about. There is something about the audience member having satisfaction, whether it's something like, you know, Friday the 13th, where...
Well, I was going to ask. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish.
Oh, where it's like, oh, you know, these emotional stories that come out of someone feeling like what happened to them was unfair and the world didn't recognize it.
Yeah.
And so they wanted you to know.
Yeah.
That they thought it was unfair too in some way. So those stories start percolating up in a way. So, and I think those stories, the fiction stories, inform the nonfiction stories of the Klebolds and Harris, who may be fetishizing the Matrix and trench coats and shooting up places, but their privilege and their unawareness of their privilege, they're little assholes.
Yeah.
Like, well, so these little assholes.
Well, I'm like fascinated now, knowing that you came from this town with, you know, a lot of serial killers, a history of a lot of serial killers, because
not necessarily. There was one prominent serial killer, and then just a lot of random killing. One does, garden variety.
Well, it kind of makes so much sense to me now, because you explore these themes in, at least off the top of my head, two shows that you created. I mean, obviously you have Pushing Daisies, which is naturally about death, but then you also have Hannibal, which is the ultimate serial killer, arguably. Do you think that's what drew you to those stories, is like just being immersed in this?
Absolutely. You know, and you can kind of see, David Lynch grew up a little bit in Spokane, and you can kind of see influences of that community with The Ear in the Field and Blue Velvet and those types of things. And certainly I felt the influence growing up in an environment where, like, I remember when the first girl went missing, and she went missing. There was an Assotin County Fair, and she disappeared around there. So there was a lot of blame of, like, it was a carny, like a carny did it. Like, whoever was, you know, tightening the bolts on the Ferris wheel took this little girl, and her body was never found. But other people started to disappear around there, and really the one that kind of blew the lid off of it was a young woman named Kristen David, who unfortunately was found in pieces. And the serial killer was my assistant scoutmaster. So
really?
Allegedly.
Someone you
allegedly
knew personally?
Yeah. Wow. It was like he would fashion cutting tools out of machine grade metals, and like I remember specifically him throwing a cantaloupe in the air and cutting in half. And then when Kristen David's body showed up in pieces, and somebody like water skied it over her leg because he dumped her body parts over a bridge.
Oh God.
And I would pedal my bike out to the bridge and look at the blood stains, because I was just like, is this, like, I was trying to collapse the gap between my perception of a horror story that was real and my experience as a child in the Pacific Northwest, which was already gummy in terms of politics and social stratas.
Right, but like you knew this person, a psychologist.
I didn't know her.
Oh, okay.
The alleged.
Oh, yeah, killer. Yeah. He was an assistant scoutmaster.
Do you feel like you took elements of this man and into like some of your character building for Hannibal?
Well, there's something interesting about the way this particular serial killer was operating, because he came into a community that was several counties buttressed up against each other.
Yeah.
And one of the counties was Assotin, and the sheriff in Assotin County responded to an ad in the newspaper, like didn't go through any sort of formal police training. And that was when the first body disappeared from Assotin County. And then there were other counties. And I don't know if he was intentionally doing this, but of course we've all seen movies. People don't share information because they want the catch. They want to be able to own whatever glory will be had from apprehending a serial killer. So they weren't sharing information, which is why this guy continued to get away with it. And he was affiliated with the local civic theater, and that's where another couple of people disappeared, and three people disappeared there. And it is assumed that the third person, who was the janitor, who everybody said, oh my God, the janitor did it. And the janitor was this nicest guy that everybody loved. And as people talked about it, they realized he walked in on him murdering these two women and he killed him. And then threw the women's bodies in a ditch. And if you look at the Pacific Northwest, and there's a lot of really great documentaries about this one, Confluence is one of them, and there are all these amazing drone shots going over field after field after field of wilderness where, I mean, the assistant scoutmaster, when we'd go on rafting trips, I would assume, you know, just being a storyteller, that he was looking for places to dump bodies.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You know, because
location scouting.
Yeah. So that was a very real thing underneath a veil of, I was a child, I was 9 years old. And I think a lot of things are happening with a 9 year old. It's when our brain actually changes and we have a different relationship with ourselves and society and the world. That happens at nine. Like there's something fundamental that happens in how we process our role in relationship to the rest of the world. Yeah. All of that is not, like, we become fertile. And fertile individuals at nine. Before then, we're kind of little assholes with, you know, various levels of narcissism in terms of how we operate in the world. Mm-hmm. Around nine, eight and nine is when we go like, oh, I am a person in a world surrounded by other people in a world, and they have their story. It's not just my story. That all happens around 9 years old.
Wow.
So just developmentally.
Yeah.
So this was all happening kind of around that time for me that I was waking up to my relationship to the world as a whole, as opposed to my little world at home, trying to keep my head above water.
I'm just like blown away by this. I can't believe, were you afraid of him as a child?
It was interesting because everybody knew it and they would just say, don't be alone with him. Don't get into his van, those types of things. And
they would say that in regards to a murderous tendency rather than like a...
Yeah, don't be alone with it. It was like we were little boys and he was killing mainly young women, 12 to 22. And little boys weren't on the docket. But there were like 6 or 7 Halloweens where it's like, if you see a van, don't get to the van. Because he drove a van. He drove a yellow van. And one of the sightings for Kristen David, there's a grade that goes into the Lewis Clark Valley. And somebody saw her putting her bike into a brown van. But they saw her putting her bike into a brown van at a light changing hour. Mm-hmm. So the yellow van backlit by a setting sun may look brown. And so he drove a yellow van. That did not stop any of the parents from saying, do not be alone with this guy.
Wow.
And don't take a ride home.
That's wild. But that was it. There was no like, just don't be around him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and that kind of like woke me up to the like, the powerlessness I think a lot of parents felt, because if it were a horror movie, there would be a greater chance of heroism because we wanted to write a more interesting character. So you have Nancy's mother, who is the hero of Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah. And it was like, you're fucking with my kids, I'm gonna kill you.
Yeah.
And she was the one who sort of championed. And that's why Ronnie Blakely's performance, she's the drunk. But if you watch that movie and you watch it from the point of view of who's protecting who.
Yeah.
Ronnie Blakely is the hero of A Nightmare on Elm Street. Yes, Heather Langenkamp is the protagonist and the main hero and becomes the hero because she's one of the most activated final girls in horror cinema and certainly one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. We all love Laurie Strode, and that's because Jamie Lee Curtis's performance was so amazing. Laurie did some stupid shit.
Yeah.
Like, she dropped every weapon that she had. And whereas as Nancy was building an offensive to take on this guy in a way. But you see where she got it because her mother took action.
Yeah, but it's unlocking so much for me. And like, now that you've put it in context to the timeline of what was going on, culturally, because, you see Halloween is earlier in that timeline mm-hmm. than Nightmare on Elm Street. And so you see this kind of like agency for mothers and their children. And like, I see that in my own mother. Any like boss bitch thing I can do, I have learned from my mother. I've learned how to send good emails from my mother. She is just, it's like a, take no shit kind of thing. Prepare yourself and take no shit. But it's also, I feel with her, and I think she would say this too, because she gets sad when she sees it in me, this like helplessness sometimes to like things that like we can't do anything about that are wrong and unfair and terrifying and so frustrating that it's like infuriating. Like my mother will cry on the phone with me because her heart is broken,
right?
And it is, but you need to like train your daughters to be able to battle these monsters. Another warm breeze. I wonder, is it springtime?
Almost.
Almost?
If I were a forensic analyst studying the motions of potential serial killers or just great people, I would be inclined to say that we may have a Barbara Crampton in our future.
Oh, a Barbara Crampton on the wind.
Yes.
Ah.
Do you hear that? Do you feel that? Do you smell that?
I smell something lovely. It's great. It's rose water, a little bit of lavender, maybe some lilac, but it smells like an angel.
Very floral. Yeah.
Here I am!
Oh, hey!
Good to see you! Listen, that was just awesome listening to you talk.
Oh, thank you.
Just because you're so human and just the depth of interest that you have in the human psyche and creating all the things that you've created for us is really, I mean, it just touched my heart listening to you, because everything you talk about is just so real. And but anyway, I'm here to play a game with you. We always do. I'm the sidebar, and you know, we always do something sort of fun. So what we have come up with for you is taking all of your titles, and we're each going to pick one.
Okay.
And do a mashup of what that would be. So, you know, you are a storyteller. So with all of these different titles, you're going to pick one too. We'll each pick one. So we'll have four titles. What would the mashup, you know, in a room, in a writer's room, look like if we put all these characters and all these different stories together into one project?
One crossover.
Right? Like the ultimate one crossover. The ultimate crossover.
James, how much do you love Factor Meals?
I love Factor Meals because I don't have time, Catherine. Time is something that...
You don't have it.
It just slips their way through my fingers every day, and I think about how much time is leaving me, and I'm like, oh, but I have to eat to sustain myself, and I don't have time to make food.
There's just too many minutes in the day. You're having an existential crisis. You're like, I don't know how I'm going to do it all.
And exactly, but I do have 2 minutes to make a Factor Meal.
To put it in the microwave, it comes pre-made, it's delicious, it's healthy, it's specified to your dietary needs.
That's right.
Big and into fitness.
I've got them, yeah. My trainer is like, hey man, you gotta stop eating all these high fat things, you gotta eat better.
He's, and I'm like, eat the Factor Meals.
Don't worry, I got Factor.
And so it works out. So if you want to try Factor yourself, or if you're just too busy, or you forget to eat like I do, it's like a neurological thing.
Remember to eat.
I know. I feel like I don't feel hunger. This is like a real thing.
Oh, yeah?
I think I have a neurological imbalance where I don't feel hunger.
Oh, no.
I don't know. It's like an evolutionary mechanism. But anyway, thanks to Factor Meals, I don't have to worry about that, about
right.
accidentally killing myself from starvation. I can just use Factor. And if you want to use Factor and support the show, you can go to factormeals.com/screamdreams50 and use the code screamdreams50.
Why is it 50?
Because 50% off.
That's right.
50% off to get, or no, it's not. That's a lie.
Ha!
wait, actually, yes, it is. 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. So so it's like a double whammy.
That's
it's
right.
Like Scream Dreams 50, you get 50 and then 20. What's that? That's 70, really, when you think about
that's
it.
That's not math, but. But that first one is half off.
It is half off.
Which
so,
is great.
So if you want to support the show, head to factormeals.com/screamdreams50 and use the code screamdreams50 to get 50% off your first box and then 20% off your next box. That's code
Scream Dreams 50
at
Scream Dreams 50 factor.com.
Factor.com/screamdreams50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Don't starve to death. Get Factor Meals.
Do it.
You know what's a nightmare? Dehydration.
Yeah. You know what's an even worse nightmare? Plastic pollution.
That's why we love Liquid Death and their evil mission to murder your thirst and kill plastic pollution.
That's right. Their aluminum cans are as metal as they get. So pick some up today, because we all need something refreshing to reach for when we wake up from a nightmare.
It's true. Cheers.
Thank God I took Groundlings classes.
Right? Me too.
Yeah, they were great.
I know, I
learned
loved them.
More about about writing from Groundlings than I did from any other place.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so since you guys were talking so much about serial killers and everything else, I'll pick Hannibal.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll go pushing. No, just to throw a wrench in it, Heroes.
I'm picking Carrie.
I knew you were picking. I kind of knew it.
Yeah.
It's the only adaptation that starts with the meteorite. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did the Kim Pierce version have meteorites in it?
Was that the Julianne Moore?
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? Maybe that did.
I think it might have.
Okay. But
I'm not sure.
Anyway, I like the 2002 one.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so you can add a fourth title to that if you
want. Okay, it was
Hannibal.
Hannibal, Carrie.
Heroes.
And Heroes. Mm-hmm. Heroes. I would say Pushing Daisies.
Okay, I love that show.
Okay. Yeah,
that's probably my favorite.
Really?
Yeah, I think it has the most of me in it and probably has my sensibility, my life view more accurately represented than I would say like Hannibal does.
Yeah. Mm. Hmm. Pushing Daisies is great. My mom and I like that too. Okay. So, go ahead. You're in the mashup. How do you kick it off?
Well, since we have Heroes at play, mm-hmm. and we all know that Heroes is about ordinary people with extraordinary abilities, mm-hmm. and how that would intersect each of these stories is fairly clean because we have Carrie, who has telekinesis. She would fit into the Heroes world. Ned has an ability, which is to bring the dead back to life. Yeah. And Hannibal has an ability that would be extrasensory. Mm-hmm. So I would put all of the characters mm-hmm. into the Heroes world mm-hmm. of ordinary people with extraordinary abilities. Okay. And, you know, Siler from Heroes is very Hannibal-esque in many ways. Uh-huh. He was, you know, cutting people open and examining their brains and doing all sorts of body horror. So I would say each of these characters, Ned from Pushing Daisies, Carrie from Carrie, and Hannibal from Hannibal, all are at one level ordinary people with extraordinary abilities.
Oh. Okay. Well, I think that'd be interesting to see. But obviously, you know, the Heroes and Heroes are Heroes. And Hannibal joining up with them, I feel like he would maybe play along for a little bit, but eventually his nature would get the better of him and he would start doing very unhero-like things. And that would cause Will Graham to go after them. And I think that because Carrie's mother disapproves of her going off and joining with these other people, she would feed Will Graham information that makes him think that all of the heroes are like Hannibal. And so now you have Will Graham, who is also almost supernatural in his ability to solve problems and solve crimes. Now he's coming after all of the heroes.
Well, this is very interesting because you should be in a writer's room. This is amazing.
I just love Will Graham.
So what kinds of crimes are they trying to solve? I think maybe if we want to say that we're working on some issues that we were talking about today, you know, maybe it is about some of these, you know, school shootings and things. Mm-hmm. So it has to do with maybe these heroes solving crimes within schools.
Carrie is in high school right now, dealing with a mass shooter this time, and having to use, you know, she loses someone she cares about to a mass shooter.
Carrie.
Yes, yeah. And on top of being bullied, has to use her abilities to apprehend this man. With the help of, go ahead.
Well, there is a version of the story where Carrie is the mass shooter, because that is what happened at the prom night.
Yes, like, that's true. Carrie, that's true. That's actually very
the
true.
The bully teen going on a revenge.
Yeah,
and the 2002 version. The reason that we wanted to make it because it was post Columbine, and in the 70s when with Sissy Spacek, there was less, you know, popularization of the issue of bullying, and post Columbine, you have Carrie White, who's the ultimate Klebold and Harris.
Yes. Wow. Okay. So, do you think in this world, Hannibal then would support her in her journey?
I think Hannibal would be encouraging her and driving her toward the massacre on prom night. And I think that there is something interesting about the characters of Will Graham, which has an authority, is on the side of law enforcement, and Matt, Greg's character on Heroes, was law enforcement in a variety of degrees. And we had, what's her name? She was in The Faculty, and she was in But I'm a Cheerleader. MDB.
Yeah.
Starts with a C.
You know?
It's on
the Faculty. You looking up The Faculty?
Because I love The Faculty.
Clea DuVall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So Clea DuVall was also like in the Authority. So I'd imagine Clea DuVall would be working with Will Graham and Greg on investigating these cases and projecting a certain level of caution because there were going to be other heroes who would be forward seeing or have a second sight of some sort that they could predict some of these activities.
I wonder if some of these heroes would be younger people then at the school.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, try to take out Claire at the high school prom massacre and she's just going to regenerate. So yeah. Claire may be the only one at the prom that could take down Carrie, who's been manipulated by Hannibal to massacre the entire high school.
Yeah. I feel like this is the next
this is the new show.
This is the show. Okay. What would you call it? What would be the pilot episode and what
Eating Heroes.
Eating Heroes.
Oh my god.
I love it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, that was really fun.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us.
For playing with us.
Okay, I got to see some other people, some heroes of my own. See you later.
Seasons change so quickly here. What is next for you that the people of the internet should look out for, the people of the world, anyone listening?
I just finished a film with Mads Mikkelsen and Sigourney Weaver and Dave Dastmalchian and Sheila Atim and a wonderful young actress named Sophie Sloan called Dust Bunny, about a little girl who hires a hitman to kill the monster under her bed.
Love it.
Not sure when that's going to be coming out, but Lionsgate will be distributing it, and I'm told we will have a theatrical release, which is great.
See it in theaters, everybody.
Yeah. And Speeding Down the Tarmac for Crystal Lake, which will start filming in July and will come out in 2025.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
If you liked what you listened to, let us know. Let us know about your own nightmares. You know, reach out to each other, our community, for support. Always like, subscribe, follow on all podcast platforms, on YouTube. Our Patreon is always really helpful. Please subscribe to that if you can.
Ring the bell.
Ring the bell. Always ring the bell. Mm-hmm. Until next time, I'm Catherine Corcoran.
I'm James A. Janisse. Be sure to leave the light on. Ha 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 ha